On this recorded podcast, our guest, and very welcome when he is indeed, is Donald Rumsfeld, who is the author of a book that I gather is a bestseller and will remain so for many years, Rumsfeld's Rules. How many of those are there?
Well, there's just under 400, I think. And is that about right? Just under 400. And the last one says, if you ever have rules, never have more than 10.
Yes. Well, you remember George Orwell's 10 rules for good writing. He gives you 9 of them, and then he says, and the 10th rule is, disobey any of the prior rules if you are so moved.
That's right. That's one of my rules, too. I make a statement that this generalizations are always wrong, including this one.
I have been twice in your presence that is in the same room. No reason why you would know that. But once was more recently, and this is a good 10 years ago also probably, at a private dining club in Chicago at Le Nomade. In 1965, I arrived at the University of Chicago as a very junior professor, and I was invited by Saul Tax, an anthropologist who had organized a big conference on the future of the military draft, to attend that 2 or 3 day conference.
Margaret Mead, Ted Kennedy.
Exactly.
Milton Friedman.
All the above.
Milt Rosenberg, Don Rumsfeld.
Somebody whispered to me right after you made a statement on the opening day, said, that's a possible future president of the United States. The prediction was a little bit off, but you've been the friend of many presidents.
Indeed.
And the very close working associate of many presidents. I want to go directly to the rules and directly to an aspect of your own history. Indeed, the most dramatic moment in your history in government, and that is as one of the close advisors of the president, one of the decision makers, in fact, in, I guess, the years 2003, as to whether to go forward with the contemplated plan to invade Iraq and to topple Saddam Hussein. Would any of your Rumsfeld's rules have been applicable there, which you should have obeyed but didn't?
Well, I'm sure there many of them would be. One of them, the first thing I should say about Rumsfeld's rules is they're not all Rumsfeld's. They're basically by people a lot smarter than I am. And they're not all rules. Some of them are humorous, some of them are anecdotes, and some of them are thoughts as opposed to rules. Certainly, the one by Mike Hayden, former director of the CIA and former head of the National Security Agency, where he says, if it's a fact, it's not intelligence. If it's intelligence, it's not a fact. And the fact that George Tenet and the intelligence community in the United States had come to conclusions that stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons still existed. And after the war, it turned out that Charles Delfer's report, the authoritative report, concluded that the precursors were there and the people were there and the facilities were there. But for whatever reason, the stockpiles had been either moved out of the country or destroyed.
And, of course, his famous comment was, it's a slam dunk, Mr. President. Slam dunk that the stockpiles exist.
But on the other hand, you've got to remember this, that the same intelligence was provided to the United States Senate and the House, and the evidence was presented such as it was. Again, it was intelligence, not a fact. And it was supported by Senator Hillary Clinton and Senator John Kerry and by Senator Jay Rockefeller, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee in the Senate, all Democrats. And, of course, the policy of the United States had been to have regime change since the Clinton administration, when both houses of Congress, Democratic controlled, passed regime change and President Clinton signed it. And the UN supported President Bush's resolutions. And the basic allies in Europe, Germany and France and others, agreed with the intelligence. So it's a fascinating thing. And that rule is, I think, a good one, important to remember. If it's intelligence, it's not a fact.
It seems to me inevitably true, just by the record it has piled up since your resignation, or even before your resignation as Secretary of Defense. I believe that came in 2006 or thereabouts. It's true that if you're faulted for any one thing, it is for your having gone along with the decision to invade Iraq. Though you're perfectly right in noting that the history is that just about everybody else was in favor of it, including members of both parties, including our allies, et cetera, et cetera. Still.
And it was Colin Powell who made the presentation. Here's a man who'd experienced with intelligence more than anyone in the administration, spent his whole life dealing with intelligence products, and he's the one who made the case to the United Nations on behalf of the country.
Though he has, in more recent years, sort of criticized himself for having gone along.
Gone along? He made the case.
Yes.
What is this, gone along?
Well, in the councils of government, as you guys said around.
Oh, sure. I mean, the president's the president. He's the one who got elected.
Overall, what is your evaluation? I want to turn to Rumsfeld's rules shortly and have you elaborate upon some of them. Some of them are really quite charming. Some of them are rather arresting for the thought that they provoke. But still, staying with this topic for just a moment, as you look back on it now and as you evaluate all that has happened, what is your sense of whether it was the right decision, whether even though the WMDs weren't readily available for the inspectors, was it all in all a good contribution to the making of further history, or would we have been better off if we had simply left things alone in Iraq, even though we had to get involved in Afghanistan?
Well, when I was Middle East envoy for President Reagan, one of the cables I sent back ended up in Rumsfeld's rules, and it said it's easier to get into something than it is to get out of it.
Yep.
And I think given the fact that the Johns Hopkins Dark Winter study had just come out, and the conclusion was that if smallpox were put in three locations in the United States, you'd end up with up to 1 million Americans dead within a year. That was the backdrop to President Bush's decision. And you know, even in retrospect, looking back at it, I think his decision was a very rational one. You don't have, with the lethality of weapons today, you don't have the margin for error you did in earlier periods. And to be wrong on that, where it could be not 3,000, but 30,000, 300,000, or up to 1 million with smallpox, it seems to me that he probably made what had to be the right decision. Now, the next step then is, what is the decision? Is it to replace Saddam Hussein and then stay there, or to pass responsibility for the country over to Iraqis in a more rapid pace? I wrote a book called Known and Unknown that where I talk about the fact that there was a debate and discussion as to how fast responsibility should be turned over to the Iraqi people. And I favored a more rapid turnover, and what we've seen is a more leisurely one.
Yes, and what we've seen by way of ultimate outcome is possibly a government that is not as stable as we had hoped by now, even though the current president insists that peace has been achieved in Iraq. Only a few days ago, once again, some 60 to 70 Shiite citizens were blown up in a marketplace, I believe. The persisting war between the Sunni and the Shia reflects.
That's a strong word, war.
What would you call it?
There's a lot of tension up between them. There always has been, and at least for the foreseeable future, I think there will be.
Well, when you blow up people almost every weekend, and each side has been blowing up the other side.
How many people get killed in Chicago every weekend?
Well, quite a few. Far too many, as you well know.
But you don't have that number on the tip of your tongue.
Oh, yes, I do.
What is it?
It varies from weekend to weekend. I think last weekend it was about 7 or 8 people who were killed, and that's a low number.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Same thing in Washington, D.C. and other cities.
I
mean, if you look at the path the United States took from the Revolution, we had slaves into the 1800s. We killed 600,000-plus Americans in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Women didn't vote into the 1900s. Went through some violent economic difficult times. It isn't an easy path. And if you look at other countries, I mean, right now, what's going on in Sudan? They think of the genocide in Africa in locations and the bombings in London. I mean, that's the world we live in, I think. It's not a pretty one. It's an untidy, a difficult one.
segueing from Iraq to some of Rumsfeld's rules, one that is directly applicable to what we've so far discussed, is quite simply stated, if you are not criticized, you may not be doing much.
The other rule in there along that line is that dogs don't bark at parked cars.
I love that. What are some of the sources that you've drawn these from?
Well, you know, I've got Mrs. Thatcher in there where she says the trouble with socialism is that pretty Wonderful. Soon you run out of other people's yeah. money.
What are the great quotations?
Lynn Cheney's the one who gave me dogs don't bark at parked cars.
Uh-huh.
Winston Churchill's. He says dictators ride the to and fro on the tiger and they're afraid to get off, mm-hmm. which is, of course, probably pretty applicable to North Korea at the present time. One of the ones I found I was a Navy pilot in a handbook for a plane I was flying. It said, if you're lost in the airplane, climb, conserve, and confess. And if you think about it, we all get lost from time to time. And that isn't bad advice, to step back, take a deep breath, confess you're lost, and ask for help. Try to get some help, some smart people around you. It's that old SNJ handbook rule wouldn't be bad for the folks in the White House right now. There's a storm going on with things.
Yeah.
And at that point, you've really just got to come to a stop and make sure you get down to ground truth.
You've got a number of quotations in a section directly concerned with serving in the White House, which, of course, you did as before you were Secretary of Defense. You were Secretary of Defense twice, but you were also Chief of Staff and so on.
For Gerald Ford.
For Gerald Ford, whom you then went on to serve as Secretary of Defense. Here are some of the White House rules. If in doubt, move directions up to the President. See that the President, the Cabinet, and the staff are informed. If cut out of the information flow, their decisions may be poor, not made, or not confidently or persuasively implemented. Don't be a bottleneck. If a matter is not a decision for the President or you, delegate it. Force responsibility down and out. Find problem areas, add structure, and delegate. The pressure is to do the reverse, resist it. So we've got there's a philosophy here about how to serve a president who is embattled and who has very difficult decisions to make. And how might you overall summarize that philosophy?
How would I summarize my philosophy?
Your philosophy as for future chiefs of staff and other high-placed White House officials.
Well, the White House is a pressure cooker. There's just no question. The folks in there now have got very tough jobs. And as George Shultz said, in those jobs, the days are long and the years are short. And I think the important thing is that the American people elect a president to be a leader and not to be a micromanager, but to be a leader and to develop strategic direction for the country and to then bring into play people who have skills and talents and experiences that are needed in government. The same thing's true in the business, in the private sector. That's what a head of a corporation has to do. But importantly, I think you ask a philosophy. I think the first thing we have to do is recognize that we lead in the United States, even in the military, we lead by consent, not command. And that means that for people to consent, they have to be persuaded. And to be persuaded, the person has to be believable. And the worst thing you can do is your currency is believability and truthfulness and having people have a high degree of confidence in that.
We are talking at the end of May, though this podcast will be available for some time to come after that. Right now, what is the credibility level of some of the people around the president in the White House?
Well, I think that to the extent any leader, a president, this one or previous ones or future ones or business leaders, to the extent they say things or the people speak on their behalf, saying things that turn out within a relatively short period to be wrong and to not be the case, you lose credibility and trust is eroded and you begin draining the reservoir of trust that exists. And that that dramatically reduces your leverage, your ability to persuade, your leadership strength. And so it has to be treasured and husbanded and preserved treasured to the extent it goes. One of the rules in there, I think it was Mark Twain, said trust leaves on horseback and returns on foot. It's very easy to lose it.
But on the other hand, surely you will agree, or will you agree, that one of the intrinsically false statements made by an American president was Jimmy Carter's when he said at the very beginning of his term, one thing I will promise you, I'll never lie to you. Is it at all possible to govern without telling some lies, or at least...
Absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely. The idea that anyone has to lie to govern in this country is just contradictory to history and reality. That what a leader must do is not lie, because once you lie, and I don't even mean lie, I don't even like the word, once you mislead even by accident, you end up losing credibility. And if you lose credibility, you can't lead in this country. And I think your comment that a person has to lie to lead is a terrible thought.
Well, what I have in mind, at least, is...
I don't remember ever thinking that a Gerald Ford would even think about lying.
But would most presidents and those that counsel the president at some point suggest there are some things we can't make public? You're not lying when you hold facts back, but lots of facts are held back, surely.
Oh, sure. That's not a lie, my lord.
No.
You've got national
that's
security.
That's an evasion. Yeah.
You'd be damaging your country and causing the death of people who serve this country if you just spewed out every thought in your head and every secret you knew. But that's a very different thing from lying.
Yeah. Well, I would like to believe that all of our presidents and all of their staff members have been totally ingenuous with regard to all public issues, but I have a sense that sometimes they are not. Though I'm not talking about the administration that you served in. Let's go back to the maxims.
Well, let me punctuate what I said.
Do please.
Any president who decides he's going to consciously lie or ask someone on his staff to go out and consciously make a absolutely false statement is just making an enormous mistake and will pay a big penalty. People can be mistaken. Don't get me wrong. I mean, goodness, one of my rules is I stand by what I meant. But people in leadership positions in a democracy do not have to lie, and good ones don't.
One of the strangest moments in the history of the presidency occurred in the second term of Bill Clinton. And I refer, of course, to the affair with the young lady who he assured us was innocent, as was he, of any kind of sexual liaison. And he had members of his cabinet reinforce that and testify that, to the press at least, that they knew that to be true.
And I'll bet you anything they believed what they said was true. I bet you he told them something that wasn't true. They went, I think it was Madeleine Albright.
Exactly.
Went out and said it, and he paid a big penalty for that.
Well, what penalty did he pay, actually? He was, to be sure, impeached, and that was very quickly processed through, so there was no action against him beyond the trial before the Senate.
You know, he wasn't convicted. He was impeached.
Yes, that's what I said.
By the House, yeah. You know, what penalty did he pay? If he picked up the phone and asked Madeleine Albright for something, I would think she would raise her eyebrow.
Even to this day?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. You know, the people were forgiving people. But I think as a political leader, he damaged himself considerably. And
yeah,
I could be wrong, but that's my view. At least with a lot of people, he did. Now, he's a darn good politician, and he's gone off and done good things subsequently since leaving the president, and he's a charming person. And has he recouped from that? Maybe. But as a president and a leader, he hurt himself by not being truthful with the American people, I would say.
Another Rumsfeld rule, which reminds one of a line from one of Shakespeare's histories. Quote, "Reduce the number of lawyers. They are like beavers. They get in the middle of the stream and dam it up."
You know how many lawyers there are in the Pentagon? In the Department of Defense, there are 10,000.
Yes, I'm not surprised.
we have such a litigious society that everyone has to be lawyered up at every level of government these days. It's too bad.
A number of these maxims relate to the world of business as well as to the world of government. And what lots of people don't know about you, or may have read but don't remember, is that you were, when out of government, a business executive. I remember you ran the Searle Corporation, isn't that right?
I did. I was the chief executive of G.D. Searle, a pharmaceutical company, yeah. Chief executive of General Instrument, electronics company, and chairman of the board of Gilead Sciences, a biotechnology company.
Somebody once told me, is this apocryphal or is it true? There's a particular product produced by Searle to drink to give you bulk in your digestion. I forget the name of it.
It's called Metamucil.
Metamucil, exactly. That's the one. And that it wasn't doing too well because it didn't taste good. And you said, give it a flavor, make it orange. And they did, and it became a bestseller. Is that true?
I doubt it. I can't remember what I said, but it is a product that is, I believe, still today the largest selling bulk laxative.
Yeah.
And it's prescribed by doctors, particularly for women who are pregnant.
But you did not turn it orange. Somebody else did that.
I don't remember. I can't say I did or didn't. But it is a terrific product and is used widely all around the world today.
What are you doing with
this? I know what was done.
Yes.
Something I did do with respect to it is, I was there, NutraSweet was approved by the Food and Drug Administration, having been approved and then the approval stayed and withheld. And it got reapproved when I was there. And they used it in Metamucil so that it was low calorie to no calorie.
Mm-hmm.
That I did. I don't remember who did the orange flavored, but that's the best kind. I can recommend it highly.
You got a quotation from Professor Louis Sarrett Sr. I'm not sure who he is. Your uncle.
He was my uncle, Lou Sarrett. He was in the speech school at Northwestern and a poet and a good friend.
Oh, really?
Paul Sandberg's. They used to go out and give talks.
Well, the quotation, which appeals to me a great deal, is persuasion is a two-edged sword. Reason and emotion plunge it deep.
He used that in some of his lectures, and he was a wonderful, wonderful man. He married my mother's sister, so he was my uncle, and his son is the man who synthesized cortisone for Merck Laboratory.
Really? Really?
But Uncle Lou he wrote what was the basic text for speech. It was called Surrett and Foster, and it was taught in speech schools all across the country. And his point was important. To be persuasive, you need reason to sustain anything. There has to be reason to it, but there has to be emotion to get people moving and up and at it. And I always liked that saying, persuasion is a two-edged sword, plunge it deep.
The reference to reason and emotion, of course, also invokes the great maxim of Blaise Pascal, who says the heart has its reasons that reason does not know.
That's good. I like that.
You know, I must tell you, this is just a matter of mere gossip or mere personal report. I was with some friends who live in Winnetka just about a week or 10 days ago.
I probably used to mow their lawn.
Well, they're younger than you a bit, but their house stands on Elm Street, and the lady of the family, as we were talking about the house, pointed to another house out the window on the next street that kind of runs into Elm Street and says, that's where Donald Rumsfeld was raised. Not that house. His original house was pulled down, and they built up this big thing instead. But Rumsfeld grew up sort of in our backyard, said she.
In a little bitty house at 545 Provident Avenue with the corner of, just off the corner of Provident and Elm.
So she was right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, where the two intersect, Provident and Elm. You're very much an Illinois man.
I am. Born in Chicago, St. Luke's Hospital.
Yeah. And
my grandmother worked in Marshall Field selling shoes from the time she was about 19 till she died. She lived with us.
Uh-huh.
So did her mother. Both talked German to each other.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
My mom was a school teacher in that area at Kenilworth and North Shore Country Day. And my dad sold houses out of the Lincoln Avenue Baird & Warner office for after World War II until he passed away.
What are your years in the in naval aviation?
Well, it was just a wonderful time. My dad served in the Navy during World War II on an aircraft carrier. He was an old man. He was 40 years old, had a wife and kids, and he ended up going out there. And I was always kind of attracted to the Navy. I lived in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, at a blimp base first in 42, I guess, and then in 43 in Bremerton, Washington, where the carrier was being done, and then in Coronado, California, the last year and a half of the war. But I was a Navy pilot. I loved it, and have a lot of respect for the Navy. I think the all-volunteer military we have has really produced the finest military in our history and very likely in the world. And everyone there is there because they want to be there, and I think Dr. Milton Friedman was one of the ones who encouraged that. And Richard Nixon, to his credit, helped push it through Congress. I introduced the original legislation, as I recall, in the 60s. And Richard Nixon took a risk and pushed it through, and it's worked out very well. We're a fortunate country. Everyone in there raised their hand and said, I want to serve, and that's a good thing.
But something seems to be, if it hasn't gone wrong, at least is a little bit troubling in the military today. We get increasing concern over number of suicides, number of sexual assaults, etc. You know, there's been a good deal of tumult about that only within the last few weeks.
I've seen the articles, and I haven't had a chance to talk to anyone knowledgeable about it. But I think that one thing one ought to look at is what's going on in that same age group, the same cohort in the private side.
Uh-huh.
We undoubtedly have much better data on the military side than we do in the private sector. And I'm not saying that I know. I'm saying I don't know, which is another one of my rules. When you don't know, it's best to say you don't know. But I think the people who are concerned about that, and all of us have to be. I mean, my Lord, section. The other thing is apparently in the military a blending between something that is verbal and something that's physical. And they're all lumped together under, I believe, the characterization or the phrase sexual assault, because you can have a verbal assault. But I think when people see that, they think it's physical.
To be sure, yeah.
And I don't think, and in the private sector, they disaggregate those and talk about them differently. So I think there's a lot we don't know. On the other hand, anywhere, private sector, military, government, anyone ought to have a zero tolerance for somebody imposing their themselves on another person.
As we close, I want to offer you a last quotation of a Rumsfeld rule. It's attributed to W.H. Auden, the poet, who says, "History marches to the drum of a clear idea." And ask you, have you marched to the drum of a particularly clear idea? And what idea was that?
Well, I'd come back to the word trust. I worked for a congressman who was criticized for something, and he lost by one switch vote per precinct. And it registered on me. And I think that the American people deserve to have people serving who are trustworthy, and that is just enormously important. And I think that clear idea where public servants and political leaders or even business leaders who understand that, they benefit from it. And if they are attentive to that, because you to have trust eroded in any way, even in your private life with your family, is something that weakens you and makes anyone less effective. And I think that people need to know that. It's basically the golden rule. You do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And you want others to be trustworthy, and therefore you owe them that.
Excellently said, and thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking with Donald Rumsfeld and talking around and drawing from his new book, Rumsfeld's Rules. And I very much appreciate your taking the time. Thank you, sir.
You bet.